This program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, our guest, a frequent visitor or a sometime visitor to Media Matters, Laura Flanders, the host of The Laura Flanders Show, heard weekends 7 to 10 p.m. on the new Air America radio network, and also the host of Your Call, a daily public radio show. Flanders founded the Women's Desk at FAIR. She's a longtime journalist, radio commentator, and media critic. She's a widely published author. We've had her on in the past to talk about her book, Bush Women, Tales of a Cynical Species. And we are here today to talk with Laura Flanders about her brand new book, which she edited, just came out, called The W Effect, Bush's War on Women. So please join me in welcoming Laura Flanders to our show. Laura, are you there?
I'm here.
Well, it's really a treat to have you on the air again. We had you about 6 months ago, I think.
Oh, wasn't it that seems long? Like ages. I've missed you, Bob.
Oh, I've missed you, too. And since then, you've become a national radio star on Air America.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
How is that going, by the way?
I think it's fascinating, you know? I mean, we're really calling the bluff of all those folks who said there was no market, particularly in the commercial radio listening arena, for liberal, in my case, kind of left progressive talk. We're second in the market in New York, and I think third going on second in Portland. And picking up stations all the time. So whether the advertisers will follow, we'll see. We're doing well at the moment. But it's definitely kicked out of the park, this notion that there's just nobody interested. There are millions of people interested. That's clear.
Yeah, I've had a chance to listen to your show. And for people who might not have it in their local area, like here, it is available online on the web at, is it airamericaradio.com? Is that right?
That's right. And we're about to be in Ann Arbor.
About to be in Ann Arbor. We're here in Champaign, Urbana, so we've got a stretch to make it to Ann Arbor.
Well, we've just picked up Ann Arbor and San Diego Monday, so I guess we're excited about it.
Yeah, that's good news. Well, let's talk about your new book, Laura, and what I'd like to do is just read the opening few sentences from your introduction to the book, because I think it really sets up a lot of what this book's about. Here I go. George W. Bush campaigned for the presidency of the United States, declaring that W is for women. At the Republican Party convention in 2000, his supporters wore that slogan emblazoned on buttons pinned to their chest. As one female delegate from Texas told me, Bush's agenda puts women front and center. For women, George has nothing but respect. Well, 280-some pages later, one probably doesn't come to that conclusion after reading this book. Talk a little bit about why you wrote this book, what's in the book, and what the key themes are, if you would.
Well, the key themes are, as you just laid out at from the very beginning, that this is an administration that, interestingly, for a Republican presidency, has tried to veil itself, as it were, its gender politics and cast itself as friendly towards women. Now, the most simple ways it's done that is to talk about liberating women in Afghanistan or Iraq, and the contributors to this book who are Afghan and Iraqi contradict that in short order. The more sophisticated ways in which this administration has cast itself not as female foe, but as kind of family friendly, I think has been kind of fascinating, because you've had proposals like Leave No Child Behind or the Family Time Flexibility Act that sound like they're good for families and yet turn out to be quite the opposite. What we suffer from, though, still in this country is a media that doesn't look at women's issues all that clearly, all that consistently, all that carefully. And we felt it was important, the books put out by the Feminist Press, to try to put before the public the facts, what's actually gone down.
Could you, before we go into the book and the W factor, or the W effect in any detail, let's just back up and talk about that point you just started, the point of departure here, which is that the media in general, the news media, have not been especially effective in covering issues of concern to women. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, you and I have been talking about this for a long time. I mean, we have a media that tend to cover women's issues, and I don't even like the term. I believe all issues are women's issues and vice versa. But they tend to cover things having to do with women or the gender impact of policy on the special interest pages and human interest features, that kind of thing, buried inside the news. What we you know, we still, and the other, so that's one aspect. The other aspect is we still see women's issues characterized as only Roe v. Wade, abortion, and choice. Clearly, we're talking about policy priorities that are much broader than that. But I think it goes down to, you know, we tend in this society, and the media do this more than anyone, to consider women as a kind of minority special interest group. But we're not a minority. We're the majority of the population. We're going to decide this election. We usually do. And we're not a special interest group. Women are the canaries in the mine of our economy, of our healthcare system, of our environment. If you want to look at how policies are affecting society as a whole, if you leave out women, well, you're not going to get a clue, because women are those, the experience that women have and the people that women care for, the elderly, the young, the vulnerable, the sick, are the ones who first show the pain in our society, who first witness the suffering. And you're talking, you can talk about the labor force, too. I mean, we've got one out of five workers in this country, one out of four, according to some statistics, working for poverty-level wages. 58% of them are women. And we're not talking minority women, white women with a high school diploma. So, again, I think if we and the media took women as seriously as we take men, some of the sort of status quo would simply be intolerable, and the public would be aware that there's a crisis going on.
We're talking to Laura Flanders today, the editor of the brand-new book, The W Effect, Bush's War on Women. If you'd like to call in and have a question or comment for Laura Flanders here at Media Matters, the phone number is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And the book is really a compilation of, I'm just ballparking it, roughly 35 or 40 essays on a whole range of issues. And like you said, it defines issues of importance to women across the whole panoply of social and political questions, the economy, war and peace, social issues, civil liberties. How did you decide to write this book? What drove you to edit it, to put it together?
Well, in fact, I was approached by the Feminist Press, but it seemed like a good companion volume to the Bushwomen book. Bushwomen, Tales of a Cynical Species, which came out from Verso earlier this year, was about the people in this administration and the kind of cynical use of women in the cabinet to pursue very anti-feminist goals. And this seemed like the companion piece. That was about the people. This is about the policies. Another important point made in this book by Richard Goldstein, a contributor to the Village Voice, is that a lot of what's happened in the last 3 years, the changes that have been put into effect by the Bush administration, have been put into effect in a stealthy way, in a secret behind-the-scenes kind of way. Goldstein talks about it as stealth misogyny. These aren't laws that have been proposed, discussed, debated, put onto the floor of the Senate or the House for national consideration. We've seen a turnaround in healthcare policy, welfare policy, education, even our environmental policy, through the passing of, through the making of new regulations that aren't up for public review, and through the appointing of activist ideologues into public jobs who have carried out the laws or not carried them out as they saw fit. So another impetus for the book was a lot of what's been going on needs to be contradicted. And a lot of what, you know, the spin coming out of the White House needs to be contradicted and hasn't been. A lot of what's been happening has been happening behind closed doors. And the final point is we still don't hear enough from those with an expertise in gender issues when it comes to analyzing the policy questions of the day. So again, to pull together a lot of the experts in one place and just to remind people, you know, just as we do environmental impact studies of policy, there are people doing gender impact studies. How will this affect men and women and the power relations between them and the options for boys and girls? And we need to hear from them more. So that was another part of the purpose here.
Well, Laura, I want to go through a lot of the selections in the book and the themes taken up, but just what you said there makes me want to jump to the end of the book. And you have a chapter by Gloria Steinem, Gender Smarts. Will sex ever make us as smart as race when it comes time to vote? And that seems to pertain to some extent, I think, to what you're saying just now. What is Steinem arguing, and what's your sense?
Well, her argument is that people vote and in racial groups much more consistently than they vote in gender groups, if you will. The black population, for example, African Americans vote 97% Democrat. Women, in particular, men just slightly less than that. They've defined their interests. They're clear which party pursues their interest and which does not. The George Bush administration's effort to curry favor among African Americans is testament to his consciousness, the party's consciousness, that this is a group that they are failing miserably with. Now, they haven't come up with any policies to attract African Americans, of course, but they're pursuing those voters by dissuading them from voting for Democrats. The gender, you know, women have... There has been a gender gap at the polls since the 1980s, but I think Gloria's point is that women have less well understood where their interests lie and have less well figured out how to wield their political muscle. Her contention, and I think a lot of people would agree, is the Democratic Party has come to take women to a certain extent for granted and to assume they'll get our votes simply if they say they will defend Roe v. Wade. One of the things that we've seen in the party over the last 15 years is a kind of distancing from the very constituencies that get Democratic presidents elected: women, labor, people of color, immigrants. And with women, it was conspicuous in the 1980s that the party, after having appointed Geraldine Ferraro, vice presidential candidate in 84, not only misrepresented what happened in 84, but began gradually and methodically to strip itself, really, of its strongest commitments to women's equality, namely equal pay, equal rights amendment, the commitment to the ERA dropped off the party platform, a commitment to abortion as a right, similarly, dropped off the platform quietly in 1988. And we've seen, in fact, the gender gap kind of erode to the point where white women, a majority, have voted Republican since 1990. And Gloria would say this is voting against your interest and not seeing clearly what's going on.
We're talking to Laura Flanders today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Laura Flanders is the host of The Laura Flanders Show, heard weekends 7 to 10 p.m. on the new Air America radio network, and also the host of Your Call, a daily public radio show. She's the author of several books and the editor of the brand new book, The W Effect, Bush's War on Women, that we're talking about. It's sort of a companion book to her book that was released earlier in this year, but she wrote solely a monograph, Bush Women, Tales of a Cynical Species. If you'd like to call in and have a question or comment for Laura Flanders, the number here is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Lines are open, but let's go to a caller who's been waiting patiently. Line one, you're on the air with Laura Flanders.
Yeah, my question is twofold, or it's two-pronged. First, it has to do with fundamentalism. It seems like there's been a worldwide movement towards fundamentalism in many areas, and you know, from my opinion, it negatively impacts on women's lives. And perhaps one part of that is the literal reading of scripture, trying to talk about the present by looking at some book from thousands of years ago. But and also the other side of the question is just has to do with the corporate values and corporate agenda, things like tax regulations or social programs. How are these sometimes changes in regulations, as you said, the stealth approach to changing our lives by letting us know that they're changing laws through Congress? How is this affecting women's rights and lives and their bodies and their welfare and their relationships? And, you know, how's it going to affect men?
Well, I think it's an excellent question. And one of the points that's made over and over again in the book is whether it's AIDS or taxes or healthcare or education, the Bush administration has been putting a fundamentalist ideology ahead of community safety science. I mean, you have now, 46 Nobel laureates complaining about how the Bush administration has simply disregarded the science on key topics having to do with health or sex education or AIDS. One of the points that Barbara Ehrenreich makes in this book, interestingly, is that the fundamentalist backlash in many parts of the world is a backlash to corporate expansion and a corporate expansion that has disproportionately displaced male workers. She talks about it, but just to quote briefly, she says, in asking the question, you know, why do the Islamic extremists of the Taliban embrace gender apartheid, she says perhaps the answer lies in the way that globalization has posed a particular threat to men. Western industry has displaced traditional crafts, female as well as male, and large-scale multinational controlled agriculture has downgraded the independent farmer to the status of a hired hand. And then she goes on to say that a radical reaction to that has come in the form of religious fundamentalisms that cast themselves as national resistance to global control or empire, and we're seeing this also in Iraq today, and the effects for women are disastrous because the public face of resisting empire has been veiling women, sending them home, giving men their jobs. One of the pieces that I'm most proud of putting in this book is a contribution by a woman called Riverbend, that's her nom de guerre, as it were, that she's been writing a weblog since the beginning of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. This is a very cosmopolitan Iraqi woman, a computer programmer who had traveled around the world, had been to the United States, loved Americans, hated Saddam Hussein, was kind of divided on the invasion before it began. Her article in this, which appears for the first time in a book, her writing is appearing for the first time in a book in this W Effect, starts this way. It's dated Saturday, August 23rd of 03. She says, "Females can no longer leave their homes alone. Each time I go out, either a father, uncle, or cousin has to accompany me. It feels like we've gone back 50 years ever since the beginning of the occupation." Why, she says? Well, because of violence on the streets, because of the rise of religious extremists, again, casting themselves as, you know, resistors of the imperial empire, and her own workmates threw her out of her job and gave her job to men, which suited both the economy with this massive unemployment and the ideology of resisting Western influence, like feminism.
You know, I want to follow up on the caller's question. You know, just the whole vision of feminism that the Bush, George W. Bush, posited when he ran for president in 2000, the launch pad of the book. I mean, how much of that do you think was a calculated political effort to get voters, knowing that this was a theme that would resonate well with voters who need to win an election? And how much of it was sort of this sort of vision of a feminism that was very much a traditional view of women, sort of called feminism?
Well, it's a very good point, and we've seen right-wing women forever divorcing their own personal liberation from their public stance on sexual politics. I mean, look at this administration packed with women. I call them the Bush women, who have privately enjoyed the advantages of feminism while they publicly deplore its influence, you know, and collaborate with an administration that would set women back in the workplace, in the home, and, you know, at the doctor's office. It is, I think, part of what we're seeing is a Republican strategy, and a smart one, that has kicked in the 90s to overhaul the public face of the party while not actually changing its agenda. They get it, that the party cannot continue to snag office with a voting base that is overwhelmingly white, male, and Southern. They have to somehow break down this separatism, if you will, that has hurt them so badly among women voters, people of color, immigrants, because that's where the demographics of this country is going. So part of it is genuine, I think. The other part is, genuine marketing. The other part is cover. The other part in the 2000 election, so part of it is this kind of marketing cover. The other in the 2000 election was a none too subtle appeal to all those who felt that a kind of sexual chaos had entered D.C. during the Clinton administration, and they wanted, you know, a more rigid sort of sexual order back. And, you know, this is not too separate from the Monica Lewinsky affair, of course, and Bush on the campaign trail would make references to restoring civility to Washington and, bringing, he had his supporters talking about George W. Bush will focus on what's best for America, honest men and women, decent men and women, I'm quoting now, women who will see service to our country as a great privilege and who will not stain the house. You know, now stain the house was a none too subtle reference, I think, to the the blue dress of Lewinsky. So I think in 2000 that was part of it. Right now, I think they're just desperate for every last vote they can get.
We're talking to Laura Flanders today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Laura Flanders is the host of The Laura Flanders Show, heard weekends 7 to 10 p.m. on the New Air America radio network. So you'll be hard at work again in a few hours, sounds like, Laura.
Yeah, we're having fun.
Yeah, and also the editor of a brand new book we're talking about, The W Effect, Bush's War on Women. And the book is a collection of about 40 or so pieces, and you've already mentioned a few of the authors, Gloria Steinem, Barbara Ehrenreich, yourself, you're in there.
Riverbend,
excuse me, I've got it right here, and a number of our most prominent writers, men and women, on issues of importance to our society. It's quite a collection. If you'd like to call in and have a question or comment for Laura Flanders, the number here is 333-9455. Our toll-free line is open at 1-800-222-9455. Let us, before we go back to the phone lines, let me just let you know that in the coming weeks, our guests are going to be Alex Coburn, Shelley Pingree from Common Cause, and Lawrence Lessig, the copyright and intellectual property expert from Stanford, has been on the show before. So please stay tuned to Media Matters. And for those of you who don't listen to the show live or can't get to it or miss an episode you'd like to get a hold of, you can find a whole archive of all our shows you can download and listen to at your leisure at the WILL.UIUC.EDU website, the WILL website connected to the university. If you click through to the show Media Matters, you'll find all our shows there ready to listen to. So on all that, with all that information stored, and I'm sure you're taking notes at home, let's go back to our phone lines. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Laura Flanders.
Hello. I'm calling about the topic you were just talking about. I have read in a weblog, and, you know, you just never know. Some things are just pure rumor that both of the Bush daughters are suspected of having had abortions. Whether they have or not, they're the typical, you know, they're what you were talking about, enjoying the benefits of modern feminine freedom, and yet, you know, behind a cause that that is against that. I wonder if you could speak to that, and also specifically about abortion and fertility clinics, the idea that you destroy fetuses while you are implanting them in folks who are trying to have children. That seems to me as a real something that belies the stance on abortion with the Bush administration. Can you talk to either of these things?
No, very interesting. Well, on the first thing, I talk in the Bush Women book about the women who are in this administration. I mean, these are people who have all got good educations, many of them in public schools. They had the legal right and access to family planning at the very least. Of the cabinet secretaries, the women, only one had any children at all, and that was Christy Todd Whitman. Two are in successful, unmarried, are successful unmarried professionals. They didn't feel the pressure that they had to get married and have kids in order to be a legitimate human. The remaining two are in childless marriages. They entered very late in life. Elaine Chao, completely counter to Chinese-American stereotype. No question, they've all benefited directly from feminism. And to hear that Jenna and Barbara have certainly had every, you know, to have had an abortion, I don't know. But have they had every access to every possible freedom and a whole lot of lax, you know, leeway and generosity, I think, on the part of in the part of law enforcement? Absolutely. So, you know, the hypocrisy in terms of what this Bush crew would like for their own and what they would like for everyone else is clear.
Before you go to the second point, let me do a follow-up on that, if I can, Laura, because it seems to me that, you know, in the Reagan and Bush 1 administrations, the first ladies in both those administrations, Nancy Reagan and Barbara Bush, I don't think it took a genius to read between the lines that they were not real impressed with the sort of rabid anti-abortion rights movement. That was not really, they didn't think that was helping their husbands' political careers, and they weren't really comfortable with that crowd. I don't know if you would agree with that.
Absolutely. I mean, the record is clear.
Yeah, but I mean, do you sense that's the same thing with, say, Laura Bush, or do you think that sort of tension is not as prevalent in the current Bush administration?
Well, I think it is there. I mean, I think you have, a lot of the people have made their, I mean, part of the part of what we've witnessed on the conservative side of U.S. politics is a hypocrisy and a willingness to bend your principles to fit the political demands of the age. And this is certainly true in the Bush administration, and it was obviously true in his father's lifetime. I mean, his father and Barbara Bush were both big backers of reproductive rights. Barbara was a contributor to Planned Parenthood in Texas. George Herbert Walker Bush was so fervent a supporter of family planning on the government dime that they called him Rubbers in Congress. I mean, this is a guy who in the 70s, when he was running in the primaries against Reagan, ran as a pro-choice Republican and had the backing of progressive, you know, or, you know, today they count as progressive, you know, pro-choice Republicans, particularly the Women's Caucus of the Republican Party. In those primaries, he saw that Reagan was benefiting from his relationship with the religious right, the so-called moral majority, which is neither, and he abandoned those women who had got him into the primary race, the pro-choice Republicans who'd backed him for many years, and recast himself as a friend to the right, maybe not as tight as Ronald Reagan, but tight for sure. And Nancy Bush, Barbara Bush, Laura Bush, they all of them.
Nancy Reagan, let's not get into some sort of strange
thing
here.
They all blur into one big dynasty. No, Nancy Reagan, Barbara Bush, Laura Bush have in common that they all acknowledged that they were, for at the very least, the upholding of Roe v. Wade. Laura Bush said it the day before the inauguration, and said that her husband agreed. The very next day, he announced the restoration of the gag order on family planning organizations around the world, inhibiting their ability to do basic health services.
I guess
always been that tradition, I think, and it's partly just playing politics, and it's partly, I think, trying to send two messages at once. This may look bad, but how bad could he really be? Because she says she's pro-choice.
No, I cut you off before you were able to finish the caller's second part.
Well, the second part was about reproductive rights and about this administration's contradictory attitude to life. I mean, we know that they seem to care about "quote unquote life," longer, you know, more before birth than after it. But what we do have for sure is a tremendous advance in this administration of the kind of agenda that the right could only dream of back in the 1970s. I mean, when Reagan came into power, you had something called the Family Protection Act crafted that proposed a complete ban on abortion, even if a woman's death was involved, censorship of birth control until marriage, pro-chastity program, revoke the Equal Pay Act, of course, defeat ERA. They weren't able to pass any of that stuff. The most they got rid of, the most they accomplished was opposing the ERA. Well, today, look how far they've come on each one of those fronts. We now have our first abortion ban that has no exception for a woman's health. We are censoring information about birth control and condoms at a time when this is basically a homicidal act. We're putting public money into chastity programs that have no proven effect on the stated goal of reducing poverty, and we're doing everything we can to revoke the Equal Pay Act. There's basically no enforcement of equal pay laws in this current Department of Labor. So there's been a tremendous advance, and at the same time, of course, the contradictions are there. If any of this was really about protecting, for example, fetal health, and people know about the laws that have been passed now in 17 states and the Federal Fetal Protection Act, that Unborn Victims of Violence Act, that sounds like it's great for discouraging people from hurting pregnant women, but is really about policing pregnant women during their pregnancy. If they really cared about fetal health, we wouldn't be seeing laxer rules about mercury and water. We wouldn't be seeing a kinder, gentler treatment of tobacco companies and alcohol, if we really cared about fetal health, that's where we would, as a government, be acting. But this administration is doing the opposite, which is completely in line with the caller's point that, you know, while at the same time they're controlling the pregnancies of poor women and denying them access to reproductive choices, the very richest women can do whatever the heck they want to get pregnant. And however many eggs are, even fertilized eggs are squandered in the process, then that's just fine with them.
You're listening to Laura Flanders today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Laura Flanders, the number 333-9455, our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Laura Flanders is the editor with several contributions to the brand new book, The W Effect, Bush's War on Women, just published by the Feminist Press of the City University of New York. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 4, Lansing, Illinois, you're on the air with Laura Flanders.
Hi, Laura. You rightfully criticized the Bush administration for its hateful policies, but what do you say about John Kerry and the Me Too Democrats who support the stepped-up war effort in Iraq and more troops, who support the Patriot Act, national missile defense, increased military spending, who voted and supported tax cuts for the rich, who want further tax cuts for corporations, who supported NAFTA, who want to maintain the military presence overseas that even the Bush administration wants to reduce, who uses the rhetoric as being the party of a strong America, which is to say more militarism, and all of these things mean less for social programs.
Well, I don't think much. It doesn't sound like you think much either.
I get that vibe, too. I'm a very perceptive guy.
What do you think in that regard, then, about supporting Nader?
Well, I'm not a big Nader fan, but I am a Cobb fan. I support the building of a third party, the Green Party, and in New York.
I'm sorry, Laurie, may I interrupt? I didn't hear what you said. A Cobb party?
Cobb, the guy who is running on the Green Party ticket.
I see.
Caller, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to let Laura answer you. You'll hear a lot better if you're off air and you can just listen
okay,
to her
thanks,
response.
Yeah. Great show.
Sure thing.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead, Laura.
We warmed that guy up. So, yeah, I mean, when it comes to voting, I mean, I think a lot of progressive people these days, this is no rocket science, are saying we have to get rid of Bush. And if Kerry comes into office, that's when the work really starts. I believe in supporting a third party. I do not support Ralph Nader's independent run, but I do support the candidacy of Green Party candidate Cobb. So
now you're out in California, Laura?
I'm in New York.
You're in New York now. Okay, now in New York, where Kerry almost certainly will win by a wide margin, you would vote for Cobb.
I would.
How about if you were moseying down to Pennsylvania and you lived in Philadelphia?
I would be voting for Kerry.
Okay, so you're of the...
And that's Cobb's position.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is no question that Kerry is a party of corporate empire to the same, you know, as well as George W. Bush. George W. Bush is also the candidate of a radical new type of neoconservatism that Robert Reich calls the radcons, folks who would literally rewrite the Constitution and global law in their own for-profit-only interests. When it comes to women's issues, there's no disputing it. It was under Bill Clinton that the ball got rolling with respect to faith-based funding for, you know, kooky wildcat marriage schemes.
Wildcat
well,
marriage
schemes? Madcap, I guess is
yeah.
what I was looking for. You know, this is... Our Democratic Party has been taking women's votes for granted. My complaint, my position right today is this, now, the next few months, before November, now is the time for us to make our demands of that party and the candidates who are looking for our support. And we want not lily-livered promises about a different attorney general. Well, we'll hope at the very least there's a different attorney general, but we want an attorney general who would actually enforce pro-equality law in this country and enforce the laws protecting our environment that we have passed years ago and that majorities of this country support. So, I mean, that's my response, is that no, indeed, Kerry's not the be-all and end-all, the bee's knees, the answer. But at the same time, we have a responsibility to flex muscle, to talk about what we actually do want from a candidate. And if we're choosing to vote for a third-party candidate, well, to explain very clearly why. But I do think that in the interests of, you know, the vulnerable around the planet, we have a responsibility to get rid of the worst evil. And there's no question in my mind that 4 more years of George W. Bush would wreak havoc, not just on our own country, but on the world.
I should let our listeners of Media Matters know we're going to have Alex Coburn on the air, ideally next week, but sometime in the next month. And Alex, at his website, counterpunch.org, has been publishing probably the strongest arguments among progressives on behalf of not voting for Kerry and criticism of Kerry. So that side of the argument will get a hearing before Election Day on Media Matters for those who
Well, this may be, this is one area in which my beloved Uncle Alexander and I differ.
Yes. Well, I think you have a lot of company in your side of the ledger, as I think you know. We're talking to Laura Flanders today on Media Matters. She is the editor of The W Effect, Bush's War on Women. The phone line's here, 333-9455. The toll-free number, which is open, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air with Laura Flanders.
Well, you actually just explored everything I wanted to ask about as far as you know, why you are sort of, I guess, a safe stater voting for Cobb in California, and how you deal with your uncle. And I guess I just, maybe you could explore it more. I heard your segment yesterday on having Republicans for Kerry call in, and I thought that was brilliant as far as reaching out and talking to people who, you know, have different reasons for opposing. But since you've just said that Kerry is Bush-lite as regards issues of empire, et cetera, to some extent, but you just then implied that it would be better for the world to have, for the U.S. to reject Bush. I was trying to get at the fact that it isn't just women's issues that you're saying and domestic issues.
Well, I can hear the drift.
Yeah,
no, I can hear the tension in your question, and it's a tension that I think a lot of us are facing right now. And there's certainly an argument that, as those Republicans made on my program yesterday, we can't have 4 more years of Bush because there'll be a backlash to the radical left. And I thought, well, that wouldn't sound too bad.
That's your uncle's argument.
Well, that's okay, except the backlash isn't extracted out of my hide. You know, so the backlash meaning the next 4 years before we get this glorious left-wing, you know, revival. I personally think that I cannot sentence poor women. Let's just talk about this country for a minute. But poor women in this country to 4 more years of pregnancy police by George Bush's Health and Human Services, so-called people, to pollution of their environment by the whatever corporation wants environmental guys, to the shredding of our labor law at the hands of Elaine Chao, and the endangering of workers at the behest of her administrators. I can't do it in good faith. So I'm thinking the strategy, and I appreciate the caller calling. I hope that if he listened to the segment, which was the second hour of last night's program, he perhaps listened to the first hour where we brought to the program the voice of an Iraqi reporter challenging very clearly, no uncertain terms, the mainstream conventional narrative of what's happening in Iraq. And I heard me challenging the notion that the resistance in Iraq today are all radical extremist religious maniacs. I mean, these are people who are calling for the right to direct elections, to have a say in their own constitution, to write the constitution after the election, not before, and to control their own economic resources and have some respect for their religion. This is not radical firebrand stuff, and yet you don't hear the word Muqtada al-Sadr without firebrand radical cleric before it. So I hope that the caller will give me credit that I'm working to try to anticipate the future, in that I think we have a good chance of in November, ejecting George W. Bush from office, we will then be faced with a situation where a lot of those liberals and moderate Democrats who have mobilized to eject Bush may dissipate in their energies. And I think our challenge as progressives and leftists is to try to do a whole lot of education between now and then so that we will be in a better place come January to kind of call the bluff of people that were all concerned about the ill effects of U.S. imperial rule before, while Bush was in office, and need to be as concerned when Kerry is keeping troops there. So maybe it's not a perfect solution. It's, you know, there are contradictions all over it, but we're not in a black-white political situation, and I wonder if we ever are.
We're talking to Laura Flanders today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Laura Flanders is the editor of the brand-new book, The W Effect, Bush's War on Women. We've got a full bank of callers. I promise I'm going to get to all of you, and we should probably be able to take one or two more than that. The number 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. I tell you, Laura, as soon as we start talking about the presidential race, the phone lines heat up. It's like the certain thing I can do. Line 2, Pasodum, you're on the air with Laura Flanders.
Hello, love your program.
Good.
And my, I'm going to probably stutter around, so I tried to write this down so I wouldn't goof up. Anyway, my thing with the Democratic platform weakening, do you think that that's to try to keep the center people, the like Christian fundamentalists and white voters, from becoming completely disenfranchised? Because for whatever reason, people seem to be totally ignorant of world facts and history. They get all their news from, which I don't watch it, so I hear secondhand from like your program and others like this, from Fox News, where 50% of the people think that weapons of mass destruction were found and stuff. So if you come out real strong against an issue, you're going to lose so many voters right off the bat. And then the second part, which kind of falls into that, how do you reach all the voters who seem to vote on the single social galvanizing issues, like you're talking about abortion or now the gay marriage stuff, and people, and all these things seem to be, all the other policies are against their best interests, like the economy of the country and ecology and whatnot. And I guess I've stuttered enough, so thank you, and I'll let you address that. Thank you.
Well, thank you, caller.
Well, I think that the point that the caller made about people, voting against their own interest is an important one, and one that we've heard Howard Dean talk about and others. I mean, we do have, unfortunately, a country where media are able to stir up people's bigotries and play to those, to the point where people get their heads so turned around that they don't realize who's on whose side. And that's something that we've been working against, obviously, for years. When it comes to the Democratic Party weakening its agenda, I mean, there's no big mystery. In the 1970s and 80s, you had movements that were calling for radical social change. We had a lot of radical social change. I mean, we had a revolution about who could get what kind of education, who could get what kind of defense by the government, for whom was the government working? But the sort of basic things people, I mean, some of the things people were talking about were obviously reparations for slavery, were federally funded child care, were minimum income supports for the poor, radical stuff. And I think that you had a party in the 1980s that not only was terrified by those kinds of things, but also was doing the political calculations to see that they could reach out to those voters in the sort of moderate middle and win their votes, and they would never have to deal with the radicals making really uncomfortable demands. So I think what you saw under Bill Clinton and the rise of the Democratic Leadership Council in the late 1980s was a decision that we don't want to be the party of labor and women and people of color and gays and lesbians. We're going to go after those center white male voters that the Republicans are going for, and that way we get to befriend the corporations as well, because we're not actually posing any threat to them. It was a choice. And you can understand the choice and why it was made.
Do you think Kerry is making that choice too?
Well, I think he is, but at the same time, I was struck, I was at the Democratic Convention, and I was struck by the fact that the base of the party, I think, is more progressive, more diverse, more adamant, more activist than it has been for many years. So while the base of the while the people on the stage, I think, are still hesitant, or are still, you know, heading for those, have their eyes on those social moderates, the center moderates, I think the activists are getting it, that the voting pool that's going to pull this off are the people who haven't been inspired to vote before, the people who haven't felt they had a party working on their behalf. So I think without major overhaul of our campaign laws and how we run elections, we're never going to see a situation where corporations don't call the shots. But we are coming to a, I think we are seeing some movement among people who realize this is, you know, we can't continue to have a country where half the people don't vote.
You're listening to Laura Flanders, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Laura is the editor of the new book, The W Effect, Bush's War on Women. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 3, Champagne, you're on the air with Laura Flanders.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call. I want to thank you for your last time here because it turned me on to Bush women, and it's a fabulous read.
Oh, thank you.
I had another question. Do you address the notion that this administration could dare to commit a felony and out Valerie Plame?
They did dare, yeah.
And does that have to do with the fact that she's just a woman?
Well, I think it does a little bit, in the same way that they dared lie about the story of Jessica Lynch and they dared completely ignore the killing of Rachel Corrie. I think there's no question that women are sacrificed, manipulated, made into symbols, with greater sleight of hand and lack of concern than men. And I think it's extraordinary that the Valerie Plame affair is getting as little attention as it is. I do think that if she was a man similarly high-placed in nuclear weapons monitoring for the CIA, we'd see more of a stink.
Well, let me put it this way, if I could turn around. If this was a President Al Gore, and the Gore administration was accused of doing this to a man, or a woman for that matter, how do you think Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity would be responding to this event right now?
We'd be deaf from the screeching.
Well, you know, it's unbelievable to me that there hasn't been more outrage that this, you know, obviously the leak came from the White House. That's not been disputed.
Right, and all the people that have yet to, and one of the few people that has yet to be subpoenaed is Robert Novak.
Right, right.
Be careful. He's a graduate of our fine university. So watch
what
you say.
That's not necessarily something one to brag about in this case.
Well, I mean, let's think. I mean, there is no such thing as even-handedness, and we need to be clear about that. I mean, look at the difference between the scrutiny that Hillary Clinton was put under for her, you know, trading on Wall Street, and the lack of scrutiny that's ever been given to the fact that Laura Bush, the first lady, actually killed an ex-boyfriend of hers in a car accident when she was 17. Do you think Rush Limbaugh would ever have let Clinton, you know, Hillary get away with that if that was in her past?
That you raised that issue. Now, I've got to ask you to follow up on that because I know I'm going to have listeners during the week saying, what was that all about?
Well, when she was 3 days past her 17th birthday, Laura Bush in Texas, Midland, was driving in a car, and I think there's no question that she was under some kind of influence, had a head-on, well, not head-on, but she ran a stop sign and crashed into another car that just so happened to be driven by an ex-boyfriend of hers. He was killed. There was never any investigation. I mean, there was never any charge. There were never any charges brought. The story is never mentioned. When Laura Bush is questioned about it, when she was most recently, she said, oh, are people still talking about that? Well, he's still dead. She talks about it as a tragic incident in her life. But imagine if Hillary Clinton, if that had happened to her. Now, you know, I don't think at 17 that she probably should have been put away for life for, you know, the taking of the life of this man, which may or may not have been by accident. But those who've described the scene say this is a very flat part of the country. There's not a tree or a hill for miles. You can see cars coming from a long distance.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah. And if it had been a young black man, he'd be in jail.
Well, we've got two callers waiting very patiently. We've only got a couple minutes left, so I'm going to ask our callers to be rapid. Line 4, San Francisco, thank you for your patience. Could you please be brief?
As this is a show on media, I just would like to say that I'm pleased to see Laura Flanders' book is published by Verso, one of the best publishers and most trustworthy publishers in America. I'm glad you mentioned Alexander Coburn's Counterpunch, and I'd also like to mention sffrontline.org as a great publication. But my comment is, I think I just read a book called After the Empire by Immanuel Todd, and he has a most interesting theory that the most insidious thing about this war in Iraq is that is truly about oil, and they are using the issues of women's rights in the Middle East as a jumping-off point to get popular American support in the face of all of these lies. And I just want to bring that to your attention. Maybe you'll comment.
Well, only to say that they did exactly the same thing in the first Gulf War when, if you remember, there were a lot of heroic-looking pictures of, virile U.S. soldiers liberating poor Iraqi and Kuwaiti women covered up with veils. It was never an accurate depiction of women's life inside Iraq, for sure. And right now, the irony of this whole story is that more women are veiled in Iraq today than were before the U.S. troops set foot on the ground. So, part of the problem that part of sexism is that women can be symbolically represented in manipulative ways, partly because real flesh and blood women don't get to tell our own story often enough and tell the reality of our lives. So you can have the kind of romantic narrative laid out there, partly because it's never interrupted by the real thing.
Laura, we're down to just about a minute left, and I'd like to just return to your book, if we could, The W Effect, for a second. Let you make we've only had a chance to talk a little bit about it. Maybe in the closing minute or so, you could just talk a little bit about more what readers will find in the book when they look at it that they might not have learned yet from the program.
Well, I was amused by your estimate. There are actually 61 entries to this book. Some are short, some are long. Some of the most interesting to me are the original interviews that we conducted with lead players on both the economic and social front of women's lives. Part of the point of the book is that women's issues are not just reproductive rights. We've also got analysis here of how economic policy, tax policy, labor policy, even agriculture policy has affected women. There are unique contributions by women living in other countries and countries affected by U.S. policy, Afghanistan, Iraq. And there's a big section on media, sexism in media and how it affects our understanding of our world, and also a section on how women are fighting back, whether it's the 9/11 widows or the women in the military or the wives of people in the military or women in the Middle East, librarians fighting back against the Patriot Act, women on welfare figuring out how to organize Code Pink. So there's the whole sort of spectrum here of the problem, the solution, and I think the message is, women's issues are everybody's issues. And it used to be, if we needed any reminder of that, it used to be the case that, it was just women's jobs that were insecure and poorly paid and dangerous. It used to be just women who were fighting for privacy in their homes. It was just women that were threatened by religious fundamentalism. Well, I think we've learned that we're all threatened by all of those things. And until we take women's lives as seriously as everyone else's, we're going to continually watch the floor drop out from beneath our society.
Laura, I
and
hear
find ourselves falling down.
Laura Flanders, I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means I've got to clear out of the studio. Thank you so much for being our guest today on Media Matters.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
Laura is the author of The W Effect. We'll be back 1 week from today on Media Matters.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, holding a Welcome Back food tasting for returning students, faculty, and residents on Saturday, August 28th. Featured will be more than 100 international food items, including cheeses, olives, breads, chocolates, and more. World Harvest Foods at the intersection of 6th and University Avenue, Champaign.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, becoming partly sunny with the high in the mid-80s and south winds around 10 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy with the low in the lower 60s and south winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a chance of showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon, the high in the middle 80s with south winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. You're listening to WILL Urbana, made possible by the support of our listeners, the friends of WILL. It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is next.